This program was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
Hello everybody, this is program 2 of In the Streets Down Memory Lane, and in our first program we visited Youghal as a seaside town, and now we're moving up by the lighthouse and down towards the Devonshire Arms that was, and that's our walk today. And we're starting up by the lighthouse, and here to tell us a little bit about it is David Kelly. That lighthouse isn't the first lighthouse that was there.
Display of light at that location has an extremely long history, making that end, or this end of the town where we're now standing, equally as ancient as the centre of the town. The light was associated with a convent of St. Anne. They were Franciscan nuns, connected with the South Abbey Franciscan friars, probably dating from middle of the 13th century, maybe 1250, 1260 or something like that. It was a small convent with a tower on which they kept a beacon at night. Fairly normal for religious congregations to provide services. So the Franciscan friars, for instance, provided the ferry, which operated from South Abbey across to Monatree.
And of course they got a few bob for that, did they?
They did, of course.
And when did all this stop then with the
With the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII, both the Franciscan Friary and St. Anne's were set up for dissolution. They were finally dissolved and they were expelled at the end of the 16th century. It became defunct. Under James I, it was granted to Donal, Earl of Thomond, and it is the friary was described as the site of the friary. St. Anne's is described as the chapel of St. Anne's. So it was still there in the early 17th century. So it was a ruin right up to the 1840s when it was demolished to allow for the construction of the present lighthouse, which was first lit in 1852.
As we leave the lighthouse, we're heading down the hill towards town. The first big building we see on our left-hand side is what most people will remember as the Loretto Convent School. Here to tell us a little bit about it is Kieran Heffernan. Kieran, that big red brick we see in front of us, that actually wasn't the front door originally, was it?
No, it wasn't. Around the 1800s, there was a fashion for people who could afford it to build summer villas and summer houses near the sea. A lot of the wealthy landowners built houses in Youghal. That was actually one of them. Around the 1820s, a family called Power, they were large landowners around Clashmore and Aglish. They built smallish Georgian house, but with a lovely aspect, a beautiful view out onto the harbour. They called it Belmont. Around 1865, the house was owned by the Hydes of Castlehyde, you know, near Fermoy. The woman living it was a Lucinda Hyde, being a relation of Douglas Hyde, who was the first president of Ireland. She lived there with just one maid, apparently, fairly advanced in years. There was another man living in the town, Samuel Merrick, who by this time was very wealthy, and he was involved with the greens and brickmaking. So he was looking around for a suitable place, suitable house for his family. He always liked that house because its position, and he thought it would be a good idea as well that if he could get that house and put a brick front in so he could actually demonstrate what could be done with bricks. So it really was an advertisement for him. So he approached Miss Hyde to know if she would sell him the house, and she refused. So eventually anyway they came to an agreement that she would sell him the house on condition that she remained in it until she died, and then she would hand it over to him. And the story goes that as soon as that arrangement was made, she went off downtown to a doctor, Charles Ronayne at the time, and she said, look, you're my doctor and I want you to keep me alive for as long as you can, and I'm getting £200 a year from Mr. Merrick, and I'm going to share that with you if you can keep me alive. And she got a new lease of life, you see, with the money coming in, and herself and her maid, they dolled themselves up and they went down to the town hall where there were regular dances for the British officers at the time, and she apparently had her eye on an officer there who was recently bereaved, his wife had died. And anyway, they enjoyed it and they lived on, and she lived on, and poor Mr. Merrick was waiting and waiting for the house. But eventually he did get the house, and he started to alter it. Now, he didn't demolish the house, he kept the house, and he put what we can see here now. If you look up at it, you see that all this brick, and it's a demonstration of what can be done with the brick, because some of it is very ornamental. Now, in fact, a lot of the brick wasn't made in York. It was imported from England because they didn't have the facilities in York to actually do the very decorative brick that's over the windows and over the door, and there are gargoyles and things that are done, and that's done by a special process, and they didn't have that in York. But he got it anyway. He lengthened the house. The facade of the house really is what was important, so that some people passing by could see it. He eventually moved into the house, and that was his family home. Unfortunately, the house needed a lot of money for the upkeep of it. He invested not very wisely. He was chairman of the Cork to Crosshaven, and that didn't last very long. Okay. It actually closed down. He lost a lot of money on that project. He also invested in several other projects that didn't make much money. Then concrete blocks became the fashion for building houses, and so the brickworks went down, and eventually he had to leave, more or less ready to sell up when he died. And then his son inherited, Sammy Jr. His son eventually had to sell everything and he moved to England. He eventually became homeless. After that then, the house was sold, and it was sold to another very successful man in the town at the time, a man called Justin Condon. Justin Condon had come to Yall as a rate collector, but he set himself up as an auctioneer and valuer, and he was a stockbroker and an antiques dealer. Virtually everything he had, it turned to gold for him. He bought the place. There's an interesting story that Fabergé egg, at the time when he had it, sometime in the 1920s, or 1923 actually, the IRA in Ireland, they were actually trading arms with the communist Russians. The Russians really had no money, but they had a lot of things that they looted from various large houses in Russia. They were supposed to have also looted the crown jewels in Russia. Justin Condon had a friend in Dublin called Louis Wine, and they traded mostly in silver and gold and precious metals. The IRA were constantly coming into him with various things that they had got from Russia. They were looking to sell so that they could get money themselves too, buy arms. So Louis Wine contacted Justin Condon. "Have you any cash at all?" he said, "because I'm after buying all this stuff," he said, "I can't sell it." And so he did a deal with him, and he got a Fabergé egg. He stored the jewellery and the egg in the house, and it was interesting the way there was a safe behind a false display cabinet, and you opened the cabinet, and then there was a door further in that you opened. Eventually he also fell in hard times, because he made his money really out of investing in rubber. About 1927, that investment crashed. He was forced to part with what he had to actually to his son-in-law. Eventually the house was too big for them, and they moved out the Strand, he and his wife and his family. They sold it to the Dwyers in Cork. The Dwyers were there for about 6 or 7 years, and during that time, for some reason, they painted all the brick part now you see, yes, all of it white. The nuns next door in the Loreto Convent, they came there in 1862, and they had set up a private school. There was demand for boarding at the time in the early 1950s. So the story goes, Redmond Smith, who used to live out at Heathfield House, told me that the nuns, when they'd be saying their prayers, you see, saying their office, they'd be walking along, and every now and then they toss a medal in over next door and pray that they'd get the adjoining property. And eventually they did, because the Dwyer sorted them in 1954. The more costly things was removing the white paint off the front of it, which they did. And they cleaned all the brick and they returned it to its original colour. And the nuns were there then until 2006. In 2006, again, the nuns reduced the number, closed the school in 2006, and it was empty then for maybe about 12 years, I'd say. New construction company actually have it, and to be converted into apartments. I am ready for the storm. I'm ready
for the storm. We're we're at the Green Park now. David, can you tell us a little, how did it get the name Green Park?
Green Park is the name that was attached to the house that was built there, which later became a hotel. The site, which originally was the South Green, which it possibly took its name from, the South Green extending along where the terrace of South Abbey Houses is, and the Strand extending from there to the poison bush, as it was right. described, was granted to James de Hayes. He was a lieutenant in the French army. He was an engineer, a Huguenot refugee, in 1728. You know, he reclaimed the Strand and embanked the South Green, set out the South Green in house plots. I'm not sure if he built the house that was ultimately called Green Park, but certainly we know sometime later in that century it's belonged to it, a Parker, Mr. Parker, and it's named as Green Park.
There's a strong 1798 connection now with the Green Park, isn't there?
Well, there is. It's the Memorial Park. The house and the land was taken over by the corporation in 1833. It continued as a private house up towards the end of the century when the park was set out as a public park. And then in the early part of the 20th century, it was renamed the Memorial Park with the statue of Father O'Neill and the memorial to the people of 1798.
There's a strange connection between the Presentation Convent in Youghal and 1798, isn't there?
There is indeed, yeah. Mm. Charles O'Brien, who was one of the United Irishmen in Youghal, he came from Ballyvergan West, just outside the town there. He was executed from the clock 8 in 1798. His son Morgan was born 4 months after his execution. Morgan became a priest, had some difficulty with his vocation, was appointed as chaplain to the Presentation Sisters in Donnerail in order to allow him get his thoughts together on his vocation. While he was there, Angela Gould, who was an heiress from Portugal, joined the convent, stayed and decided that she would profess. So she brought with her a fortune and decided to set up a trust. Morgan O'Brien was a trustee. Daniel O'Connell became the lawyer to the trust. It amounted to £60,000 in 1820s, which was an awful lot of money then. And the first beneficiary of that trust was the Youghal Convent, which was founded with a £2,000 grant from the trust. And Angela Gould came as one of the founding sisters to Youghal, later becoming its superior and dying here.
And David, before we leave Green Park, I seem to recall there was a massive storm way back in the 60s. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think on the 6th and 7th of March 1962, a very severe storm driven from the other side of the Atlantic. It arrived here with a huge storm surge in the sea. It came in a southeasterly direction. The main brunt of it was taken on right on the town and right up the harbour. The tide came in and with the gale it just went straight through the wall into the park, scattering all of the seawall right across the park. The navigation boy that we used called the Black Boy ended up on Green Park Strand. Surprisingly, the original lifeboat house, which is now gone, survived the storm. And the section that has the promenade in the park also survived the storm because it was reinforced by the stiffness of the promenade. So as a result of the storm, part of the main road up the Lighthouse Hill collapsed. Reorganisation of the park, seawall and a new seawall and a new Lighthouse Hill road.
And was that the time there were yachts driven onto the front strand as well?
Captain Arbuthnot's nice little pilot boat, like a Bristol pilot boat, driven from its moorings, and it was wrecked out on the front strand.
We're now leaving the Green Park. As we move along on our walk through Youghal, we notice a large apartment complex near us. And it wasn't always an apartment complex. In fact, it was a hotel in its day. And the garden of the hotel actually was the Green Park. And here to tell us a little bit about that hotel, being there and her life there, is Valerie Mannix. What was it like? What kind of a hotel was it?
It's a bit higgledy-piggledy, a very old building. It was originally lived in 1740. 1847 by a James Leahy. We came to it in 1971. Tom and I bought it from Frankie Gowan. Frankie had been there for all of his life, and his mother had it before him, and his grandmother had it before him. We came in 71. We settled in. Tom decided immediately to change the name. Should have remained the Green Park, but he called it the All Motor Inn. We lived there for 24 years until we sold in 1995. It was demolished about 1997.
It kept its shape as an old, old house.
It was a house that was lived in since 1747. It was a two-story house over basement. We're not sure whether the two sides were built on after that time or whether they were always there. We weren't certain. The basement, at one point, we took up a floor, and under the floor we found the beach. Beautiful white sand that children could play in and make sandcastles. The original Green Park area and where the hotel was granted in 1728 to a man named John de Hayes by the Crown, and he built the house. He embanked the beach and built the grounds there.
Socially, what was the life in the hotel like?
Socially, it was good. We had a restaurant, bar, we had a nightclub, so you all people will remember Eve's. We had 20 bedrooms originally until we put in bathrooms, and then we went down to 14 bedrooms.
As a child touching age, we think that it's so, that life, love, and everything is easy to know. The only can reach us, their ways are not ours. Though they followed our futures, our freedom they bore.
As we continue our walk, we're very, very fortunate. We're bumping into John McGrath. Now, he's a person most people in Yall would know of. He grew up in the Clockgate, but he has many memories of this presentation convent here. Was it around here there was an orchard in this, or where was it in relation to the building today?
I'll tell you a story. At that time, summertime, groups of us would go together, and we'd walk towards Green Hole and walk over the rocks. We met two boys that lived in this area. What were you going to? And we said, nothing in particular, only for a climb along the rocks. So they said, what about going for a haul? Now, to explain what a haul was, gather apples from an orchard. And there was a most beautiful orchard, not too far away from us, the convent. Very, very few people ventured into the convent to rob the apples. But these two boys lived in the area, and they took us to the pathway that they would normally use. They had brackets into the wall, so we climbed over the wall and eventually got to where we could get into the orchard. We went down, but we had no bags or anything like that, only our jumpers and things. And there was a choice of fruit. We were gathering away anyway, and the next thing there was a screech of a window. A nun stuck her half her body out the window and she clapped. And I remember the name of the nun was Sister Mary of the Sacred Heart. And of course, we, not being familiar with the area, ran to try and get back over the wall, and the two lads that had been very familiar with the area said, stop, 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 there is no need, they're silent, she can't do anything. So they said, she can't inform the guardie or anybody else, so gather away.
Did you do a lot of swimming over by the diving rock?
I suppose the Green Hole was where we, most of us, learned to swim. The corner was a very, very dangerous area, and when the red flag was flying there, it was a time to avoid it and to move closer to the lighthouse. But eventually, when we were able to master swimming, we went to the lighthouse because there was a diving plank there. What fun we had there. It was absolutely beautiful.
Now we're at the Coast Guard station. Here's Alice Walsh, and Alice has been living here for about 60 years, or is it more than that, Alice?
It's 64 years in November.
How come you come to be living in this house?
I suppose I met my husband, and he brought me all the way to Yall.
Was he involved in the Coast Guard?
Well, his father and mother rented this house in about 1922, and they came to live here. He was an engineer with the Border Works, so he was living up country, and he got this house when they closed it down as a Coast Guard. So he was the first tenant. It was the CO's house, the chief officer's house. And there was six cottages then, six smaller houses. They were the petty officers at the back. When Gerard's father came here, then they decided to have a bed and breakfast as we call it today, I suppose it was guest house then, and they rechristened it South Abbey Cottage.
So you raised your family around here,
raised my family in this house.
So you have lots of memories, say, of the Green Park Hotel.
Well, the Green Park was my next door neighbour.
Yes.
And Sis and Joe Gown.
Yes.
They were my first memories. And at the other side then, next door to me, Bridie Buds lived there. She'd have been an aunt to the Buds over in Kinsale Beg. Then after that, Bridget Murphy, she lived there, and her daughter Sheila lived with her. Sheila married Con Callaghan's father, Willie Callaghan. They had three children, so they reared them there. And after that, then you had Mrs. Murphy's sister. She was a Mrs. Fitzgibbon. So she had three children. They lived there. After that, then you had the Customs and Excise had the next place, and there was an entrance from the front into that. It's for an office for them. And then Eddie Paul Lynch was next door. Eddie Paul, who became a councillor, county councillor for many years. He reared his family there. There's only one of them around now, and he's living in that bungalow there at the back. So then after that, you had Cronin's, Tony Cronin, who worked with Jim Cronin in the ESB. Himself and Joe lived there, and they had two children, Margot and Michael. So Michael is still there. When I came, the only ones that are really here since then are Michael Cronin and myself.
You have a lot of happy memories of the place.
Very happy memories, and that place here was all our garden from here over to the Green Park Hotel.
And they're all houses there now.
So I think it was about 1962, the Board of Works approached us, because we were only paying rent for the house. Right. And they approached us to know would we give up our garden, because they wanted to build a new guard station. So after discussion anyway, we decided yes. And I said a guard, the barracks would be better. We'd have a guard beside us. So the guards came there and they built the barracks, and they built two residences for the guard personnel.
And you've seen a lot of changes.
From Gibraltar Terrace in as far as the grotto. The whole place is completely transformed. I suppose if there's two or three families living in the houses in that length of time, is all that's left. The rest are all changed. The hotel, of course, over completely changed, the Walter Alley.
Yes.
Because there was three hotels there at one time, and they were all pushed up together. You had the Park View, and I think it was the Devonshire House, they called the centre one, and then the Adelphi. Well, the Adelphi and the Devonshire House went together, and then Mrs. Tucker came, and she had Park View, so she purchased the other two and christened the three hotels the Walter Alley Hotel, which it is today.
We're leaving the site of the old Motor Inn Hotel. We're moving down towards the Devonshire Arms. On our way, we notice a number of Coast Guard houses, and behind the Coast Guard houses is the Coast Guard station. And here to tell us a little bit about the Coast Guard is Clifford Windsor, whose voice will be well known to people in Youghal as our town crier. Clifford, what is the difference between a Coast Guard and a lifeboat?
Difference between a Coast Guard and the lifeboat. The Coast Guard is a legislative body by the government for water safety and pollution and things like that on the sea. The lifeboat is volunteers. They're a great bunch of lads, but they're strictly volunteers to do that.
The houses then that are around here, were they especially for the Coast Guard people?
They were for the Coast Guard people. They were probably for the riding officers before the Coast Guard was formed. They were Coast Guard houses.
Four or five of the houses there, so there must have been a serious crew of people to look after the boat.
Youghal was the main station because it was looking after Ardmore, Cabin Point, Ring and Ballymacoda. This was the area office, if you like.
When you see the actual Coast Guard vans behind you, they almost look like police cars.
The Coast Guard, not me anymore, because yeah. I was 35 years with it, but no longer with it. They are a blue light organisation, yeah.
Well, I didn't know it was the Coast Guard. What were they called before that?
They were the Revenue Commissioners, the Riding Officers and the Protective boat police, rather, yeah.
So as the Revenue Commissioners, had they functioned then in that as well?
Well, basically, when the Coast Guard was first formed, they amalgamated those three units. And when they were first formed, literally were for to stop smuggling and things like that. Yet the water police was for the water safety. America was the first place, a dedicated Coast Guard, followed by the UK, if you like, or the British Isles, in about 1820, 21, 22.
So how long were you attached to this place?
I was attached to this place literally for 35 years. When I first started, it was the Coast Life Saving Service. Then it changed to the Coast and Cliff Rescue Service. Then it changed IMES, Irish Marine Emergency Services. Now, from about 1980, they were going to go back to being Coast Guard, but it took them so long because people were still associating the Coast Guard with the English Coast Guard. They gradually got round to doing it. But if you notice, we are Coast Guard, not Coast Guard.
And if you had a particular favourite memory of your time here, is there one you can pick out?
Proudest memory, being with the Coast Guard, was receiving this as the receiving officer on this new building here. Two reasons for that is, one is it was the very first new building to be built for the Irish Coast Guard. I was very proud to be the receiving officer for this.
Now, we're at the Presentation Convent as we continue our walk. We've just meeting Marjorie MacDonald, and Marjorie has a great, great love of Yaw lace. And Yaw lace is connected with this convent. And there is a connection well back to the famine and all that. Like, there's kind of a sadness built into how it came into being, isn't there?
I don't know that you'd call it a sadness particularly. Don't like to think of it as being a sadness, quite honestly. One of the nuns really saw the opportunity of helping people out of a very bad situation. So we would hope that was an uplift rather than a sad situation. That's the way I would like to look at it.
Did it take a long time for it to catch hold as an idea, or did girls very willingly get involved?
Well, you had a lot of girls who would have been very good at embroidery and at stitching, very good at fine stitching. Now, the lace I'm talking about is not crochet lace, it's needlepoint lace.
A museum in London, and there was some Yaw lace. There was a connection with the royal family, a train.
Yes. The train was made here in Yaw for Queen Mary. The Unionist ladies in the north wanted something very special to give Queen Mary for the opening of Parliament. And this was in, if I remember rightly, 1921. She herself suggested that maybe a train would be suitable. Now, the train in question is in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. The train was commissioned by the Unionist ladies in the north. It took 60 girls working around the clock in relays, 3 months to do this train. They must have worked very, very hard, because it is a slow process. In all honesty, the more you do it, I suppose the faster you do get at working on it.
Now, having left Marjorie at CRY building today, we're heading in towards the Devonshire Arms, and on our way we're going to drop into Mary Flavin, who has the most wonderful house just almost across the road. Mary, this house has a long, long history, hasn't it?
A very long history. We didn't realise how long until some number of years back tried to get more information on it, because at one stage, Solicitor McNamara, he owned this house, who he got from Ronayne, and he owned it, the house below there, but he lived in that one. He drew up new deeds.
Do you know anything about the doorway?
Apparently the doorway is in the Georgian doorway of Ireland. I haven't seen it in this book, but I believe it's in it as one of the finest examples of a Georgian doorway. It's very Moorish in the patterning that's in it.
Very special.
It is very special. I think the whole house here is quite special.
You said it was an officer's mess at one stage.
An officer's
mess. Are there any
mess.
Traces of that left?
Michael used to always talk about the stud marks on the wooden floors upstairs, you know. The higher up you go in the house, plainer it gets. On the top floor, there's thumb latches on the doors. So I suppose the servants would have been up there.
Did they dance here?
Oh, they did. On the second level, to the front, there were sliding doors opening up two big square rooms, probably 18, 20 foot square. And if they had a big party, they'd open up these sliding doors. If they had a smaller party, they'd just contain it in one square.
Your garden, which is right onto the beach, has some special features as well. You have a lovely fountain there now in the middle.
The fountain is actually on a map dated 1861. I don't know if it was there before that, but if you tapped the square part of it, it's actually some kind of a metal. Now, the top of it is some kind of plaster or cement probably. But the square part of it is metal. And at the bottom of the garden then, we unearthed all these stones. Michael says they were there when he came in. They're 13th and 15th century stones from the Franciscan South Abbey. They were obviously picked up by someone, or maybe more than one person, and put together just to save them. They're still there, and I would like to think that they'd be there when we're all gone as well.
You also have another thing that I care for. You have another thing that I liked, which is you have a vine outside the house, and this kind of the wall is painted to look as if the vine was coming into the house. Am I right?
Yes, that's
right. And again, that teacher. Do you know everybody?
Hello.
Well, we've just had a lovely walk from the lighthouse down here at CRY building, and we're all of the friends we've met on the route we're having a chat with and a cup of coffee and reminiscing about what we've just heard and found out about things. Marjorie, were there many girls learning lace?
I went through the 1901 and the 1911
census.
That there was something like 30 that were down as lace makers. Now, that could be crochet lace, that could be needlepoint lace. That would have been for the 1901. There were less on the 1911. We do know that girls who went afterwards to work in the States and places like that, but of course the machine made came in and there's no comparison. I mean, let's face it.
Who was the lady that gave the lessons in lace making?
Veronica Stewart.
Stewart.
Yeah.
And I took the lessons from her.
As I did.
Yeah. Mm. And I have a little chart.
Yeah.
Piece of a sampler.
A
sampler with all the different things. I had that still over.
Is there a piece in the Heritage Centre?
There's a piece in the Heritage Centre. There are a few pieces here and there. We have a few people who very kindly lend us pieces of your lace when we put on a display, some absolutely magnificent pieces. And we always say, if you're in doubt as to whether it is your lace or not, bring it along. We don't want to keep it. It's your piece of lace. But just, it's lovely to
have them
documented. Yes.
Valerie, can I ask you, had you any particularly unusual guests in the hotel?
Well, we had the famous, we had Hot House Flowers that had their first cover, wasn't it, Cliff?
You
would know. Their first cover was of Greenhold, the boy named Brannock. His dad used to come in to us regularly. And every time he passed Joel, he was into us because of that. And he'd always speak Irish. He never spoke a word of English from the time he'd enter. But he was very kind. He always spoke very slowly. And he spoke Munster Irish, so you had to draw on your memories. The other people we had, the Pogues played once. And that was for Marie Moynihan's, was it Marie?
It was,
wedding.
Yeah.
Yes, and they played. And in the nightclub, as it became afterwards, it was the River Room at that stage. That was a very exciting night, I remember.
Fishing Impossible.
Fishing Impossible, well, will anyone forget those? They were a Dutch group who fished every year in Yule for 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
And they came in a purpose-made van, everything in it, every single thing they needed except beds. And they stayed with us, and we had a separate till for them because everything was charged up while they were with us. So they had their own till in the bar. And the bar was full every night because they called drinks on the house every night. So, for 2 weeks. That was when Ireland was a very reasonable place to stay. You remember them well.
What were they fishing for?
What were they fishing for, Cliff? You know more than I would.
Anything that they could catch.
So.
And I mean anything they could catch. And they used to fetch it back to the hotel, didn't they?
They did. I do remember coming down very early one morning, and I opened the cold room I'm in a big cold room, so I opened the big door anyway, and there were lobster all over the ground, crawling around. And there was a note on, please do not touch. They were a bit nuts, weren't they?
They were completely nuts.
Yes, they were. But nice, nice, nice men, yeah, nonetheless. Nice. Now, we had a guest named Jan Eita, who many, many old people will remember.
Mm-hmm.
Jan stayed with us, oh gosh, for perhaps 15 years. He was Belgian. We called him Dutch, but he wasn't actually Dutch. Yeah. He was Belgian. Jan came every single year and stayed in the same room every year. Stayed in room 46, and that was his room, and that's where he stayed. Every single year, he was very friendly with lots and lots of people in York.
Things were so different long ago. When I came to York, George was working outside in Seaford Fabrics. Mm-hmm. He changed then eventually to Blackwater Cottons. But his wages then, you'd be talking about wages now, his wages were £6.12 a week. I don't know how we lived in it, but we did. But I had the bed and breakfast at a guest house where I'm living today. And that kind of helped us out because we used to have that for the summer, and that was an extra backing for the winter months. But that was his wages. And it was supposed to be a good wage then.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the people today, if they had to go back to that? I don't know how they'd survive.
But it's not how much money, it's what you can do with the money that you have, I suppose, is the important thing.
We had four children, and we were able to rear them.
And a big garden?
Oh, we had...
And you grew vegetables?
We had a garden, there was an orchard, we had our own fruit and own vegetables, potatoes, and we had a hen run. So we had the whole lot there. So they approached us to know would we give up our garden, because they wanted to build a new Garda station. I said to George, what do we want it for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we give up the garden, and guards are still there, we have the protection, which is great.
Yeah.
But that was all our garden. As you saw the size of it. My mother and father-in-law were the first residents in the chief officer's house.
Different. Did you get a house when you were in the Coast Guard?
No, I didn't get a house when I was in the Coast Guard. When I first come to Ireland to live, it was in Dysart.
Dysart,
But when I first come to Ireland visiting in 1953, it was to Harbour View.
Right.
And went to Harbour View every year then until we come and lived here.
Yeah. Oh, you were with Miss Savage all the time.
Oh, I knew Miss Savage well.
Yes.
Lovely lady.
She was a lovely lady.
Kieran, can I ask you, when Loretta was building the Ashton Court, have you photographs of that, of what it was before?
My twin sister is a Loretta nun, and she was in York for a number of years, and then she moved to Fermoy, and she was in Clonmel. I remember going in there and photographing it sometime in the 1970s when I photographed
it. What was her name?
Sister Lubina. I don't know if you remember her.
Was she an art teacher?
She was, that's right. The house itself was very interesting when you'd go into it, because you could see the original square house that it was. And then with the way Samuel Merrick had put additions onto each side of it to enlarge the front of it. And the inside, then there's a very nice staircase in it. That's the original staircase. And they were there until, what was it, 2006, I think.
2006,
yeah.
Three schools.
That's right. And we all thought only a few years ago that it would become derelict completely. But see, the great thing now is that it will have a new lease of life.
Yeah.
It's interesting because the nuns, like a lot of nuns, saved a lot of houses in Ireland. The religious orders, brothers as well, and priests, they took over houses that were too big for families, and they saved them from being demolished.
Mm.
And save some important houses. So they're all part of our heritage, really.
Yeah.
Well, we say thank you to everybody for coming along and having a cup of coffee and sharing memories. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Street Down Memory Lane was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Presented by Kieran Greger. Sound engineer, Paul Daly. Sound engineering and editing, Thomas O'Keefe. Produced by Thomas O'Keefe. Series producer, Angela Kearns. Researcher, Angela Kearns. We would like to sincerely thank all those who took part in this program for their time, and most of all, for the memories. A Community Radio Yule production.